they would probably note that some didn't really apply, but because they were told that the statements were written especially for them, they believed what they read. This error in our information processing ability can get us into very real trouble. Astrologers, fortune tellers, mediums, psychics, and the like are well versed in the finer points of the Forer effect. With a little practice, a huckster can use only vague hints from his mark to weave an elaborate tale that seems eerily accurate and applicable. The key is that the hapless victim has to want to believe what he's being told. For this reason, the Forer effect is often called by another name, the Barnum effect, after P.T. Barnum, who famously said, "There's a sucker born every minute." Considering how universal the confirmation bias is, Barnum's quip is a gross underestimate. At the current global birth rate, there are 250 suckers born every minute, roughly one every quarter second. Let's make a memory. Like the human brain's ability to think logically, its incredible capacity for memory is a marvel. From the world capitals you memorized in seventh grade, to the phone number of your elementary school best friend, to your vivid recollections of trips, movies, and emotional experiences, there are literally billions of bits of information bouncing around in your head. Yet, here too, an amazing human feature is filled with bugs. There are all kinds of flaws in the way our brains form, store, and access memories. For instance, most people have had the experience of recalling and enjoying a vivid memory for years, only to find out later, through a recording or by comparing notes with others, that the recollection has major inaccuracies. Sometimes people remember an event as a first-person experience when they were actually bystanders. Other times they translocate the memories to a different time or place, or they change the cast of players involved. While these small errors may seem innocuous, they can have big consequences. To find them, look no further than the world of criminal justice. If a prosecutor has an eyewitness to a crime, a conviction is usually a slam dunk. If a witness positively identifies someone as the assailant whom he saw commit the act, how could he be wrong about that? If the witness had never met either the accused or the victim before, why would he lie? But researchers in the field of forensic psychology have made startling discoveries regarding the reliability of eyewitness testimony. Although you'd never know it from how police and prosecutors pursue and present evidence, there is at least three decades of research proving that eyewitness identifications are extremely biased and often mistaken, especially when it comes to violent crimes. Psychologists have used simulations to show how easily memories can be distorted after the fact, and these shed light on what is going wrong in the brains of many eyewitnesses. For example, researchers recruited volunteers and randomly assigned them to two groups. Both groups watched a video of a simulated violent crime from a fixed and limited perspective, as though they were bystanders to that crime. Afterward, both groups were asked to give a physical description of the assailant. One group was then left alone for an hour, while the other group's members were shown a lineup of possible assailants and asked if they could identify the perpetrator. However, there was a slight trick with the lineup. None of the actors was the perpetrator, but one, and only one, matched the rough physical description from each eyewitness in terms of height, build, and race. More often than not, the witness identified that person as the perpetrator, and in a majority of those cases, the witness was very sure that the identification was correct. That's a troubling outcome, of course, but it's not the most disturbing part of this experiment. Some time later, both groups were again asked to describe the perpetrator of the crime. The members of the group that had not seen a lineup gave pretty much the same descriptions that they had before. However, most of the people in the other group gave much more detailed descriptions. Seeing the lineup somehow improved their memory of the perpetrator. The increased detail that they provided always matched the actor in the lineup, not the actual perpetrator of the crime they had witnessed. When the researchers pressed the witnesses about their memories of the crime, they discovered that they were honestly reporting their recollections to the best of their ability. Their memories had been warped. This work has been expanded in lots of interesting ways and has affected how lineups are done in most states. Experts in eyewitness memory tell us that the only valid way to do a lineup is to have every single person in it, the suspect, as well as the foils, as the paid lineup actors are known, match every part of the physical description that is given by the witness. And if the eyewitness description doesn't match a suspect perfectly, which happens a lot, the foils must match the suspect, not the description. Moreover, conspicuous identifying marks and even clothing must be as similar as possible among the people in the lineup. Scars and tattoos should be covered, because if the witness remembers that the perpetrator had a neck tattoo, and only one of the men in the lineup has a neck tattoo, there is a good chance she will identify that person, even if he is innocent. Her memory of the crime will then be retroactively edited with the new person's face spliced in. Even clothing can trip this memory editing property of the brain, and it all happens without a person's conscious awareness. The false memory is as vivid as a real one. More, actually. Bystander memory is bad enough, but memories of one's own experiences are even worse. For instance, it turns out that personal traumas are also vulnerable to memory distortion. This has been documented in cases of a single traumatic event, such as a sexual assault, and sustained stresses that might involve multiple types of trauma, such as being in a war. The memory distortion most often observed with regard to trauma is that people tend to remember suffering more trauma than they really felt. This usually translates into greater severity of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD symptoms over time, as the remembered trauma grows. Not surprisingly, this deepens and prolongs the suffering associated with the trauma. In one example, researchers asked Desert Storm veterans about certain traumatic experiences, running from sniper fire, sitting with a dying soldier, and so forth, at 1 month and then at 2 months following their return from service. 88% of veterans changed their response to at least one event, and 61% changed more than one. Importantly, the majority of those changes were from, "No, that did not happen to me," to, "Yes, that happened to me." This over-remembering was associated with an increase in PTSD symptoms. Researchers, led by my colleague, Professor Deiran Strange at John Jay College, demonstrated this memory distortion with a clever set of experiments. They asked volunteers to watch a short film depicting a real fatal car accident in graphic detail. The film was split into a series of scenes separated by blank footage. Those blank spots represented missing elements, scenes that had been deleted. Some of those missing scenes were traumatic. For example, a child screaming for her parents, while others were non-traumatic. For example, the arrival of a rescue helicopter. 24 hours later, the viewers returned and were given a surprise test probing their memory of the film they were shown, as well as their thoughts and recollections about the film. The participants scored well on their ability to recognize scenes that they had indeed been shown. However, about one-fourth of the time, they recognized scenes that they hadn't actually viewed. They were far more likely to over-remember the traumatic scenes than the non-traumatic ones, and they did so with confidence. In addition, some viewers reported symptoms that were analogous to PTSD. They reported thinking about the traumatic scenes when they didn't intend or want to, and avoiding things that reminded them of the film. Interestingly, those with the PTSD-like symptoms were more likely than the others to over-remember traumatic elements of the film that they hadn't actually seen. This is further evidence of a link between PTSD symptoms and memory distortion. This consistent quirk of memory formation demands an explanation. Why would a brain with such exquisite cognitive abilities engage in self-harm by exaggerating past trauma? Is this simply an error and nothing more? Does the human brain, which, after all, only recently evolved such complex cognitive functioning, get overwhelmed in times of great emotional stress and make sloppy mistakes? Maybe. But there might be a more interesting explanation. This process of false memory formation could actually be adaptive. One possible benefit of exaggerated trauma recall is that it might serve to reinforce fear of a dangerous situation. Fear is a powerful motivator and a very important conditioning mechanism for avoiding danger. Normally, fear and aversion towards something eventually wanes if people are not repeatedly exposed to it. The strange quirk of remembering traumatic events as even more traumatic over time may serve to counter the normal tendency of fear to wear off. So again, we have a feature that is a bug, or vice versa. The house always wins. As bad as humans are at accurately remembering things that happened in the past, they may be even worse at evaluating things experienced in the present. This is pretty remarkable when you consider how essential this basic skill is to our species' survival and well-being. As you go through life, you are constantly bombarded by input from the world around you, and you can navigate this sensory storm only by making countless, often very quick decisions, hopefully more good ones than bad. To do that, you have to assign value to various things, people, ideas, and outcomes. Your brain then measures the value of various outcomes and makes decisions that add or preserve value rather than deplete it. Psychologists and economists agree that the way that people behave at a gambling table is just about the purest manifestation of what can go wrong in how humans measure value, particularly the value of money. Most humans are not very good with money. Because money can be gained and lost so quickly and easily, gambling is an incredibly focused way to probe for deep truths about how we approach problems of valuation. A great deal of psychological and economic research has focused on how humans make choices while gambling. This is not just an academic exercise. Gambling behaviors translate into many other areas. Depressingly, the lessons researchers learn about decision-making at the gambling table are often generalizable to how people live their lives. For starters, most people are terrible at the basic logic of gambling. Of course, the whole enterprise of gambling is illogical to begin with. The odds always favor the house. People know this. They know that casinos make money at their expense. Yet they gamble anyway, presumably because the thrill of the experience is worth something to them. They value the experience of it and consider gambling a hobby, like any other. Golfing, going to the movies, whatever. The money lost at the gambling tables is like the price of admission. No big deal. They know this at the outset and enjoy the exhilaration that comes with throwing their hats into the ring for a big payoff. But gambling is different from other forms of entertainment in one crucial way. People dramatically and consistently overpay for it. The vast majority of people who go to casinos walk out of them having lost more money than they intended to. When you ask gamblers at the beginning of the night how much they are prepared to lose, and then ask them at the end of the night how much they have lost, more often than not, they have lost more than their set limit. In fact, if you told them at the beginning of the night the actual amount of money they would lose, most of them wouldn't enter the casino. It may be true that people enjoy playing at the tables, but the explanation that is often given after losing money, that it was really just about having fun, is an ex post facto justification that allows them to deny, even to themselves, that they have made poor choices. The poor decisions that people make when gambling demonstrate some defects in the human psyche. Perhaps the most revealing ones, and the ones most worth mentioning, are those with parallels to other aspects of daily life. Many gamblers begin the night with a set amount of money that they are okay with losing. Let's say that, for one gambler, it's $100. When he sits at a blackjack table that has a $5 minimum bet, he will usually bet one or two chips. He wins some, he loses some. An odd thing often happens if he starts winning money. He bets more. This is the most illogical thing anyone could do. If you find yourself up $50 and then start betting $20 instead of your usual five, it will take you just two or three bad hands to lose what it took you 10 hands to win. Remember, if you play long enough, the house will eventually win. By increasing your betting when you're up, you accelerate the pace at which you'll be giving your winnings back to the house. If you find yourself up by a fair amount, you should celebrate your good luck by betting less, not more. If you do that, you have a fighting chance of going home without losing. Of course, the only real way to win is simply to quit altogether when you're ahead. But almost no one can do that. People who are that powerfully governed by logic are unlikely to find themselves in the casino in the first place. Casinos know this well. What do they do when someone has a hot streak at the table? Why, they send him free drinks. If he keeps winning, he'll get a voucher for the premium buffet. If his good luck just doesn't seem to run out, he'll find himself with a complimentary room in the hotel. The more money he wins, the nicer the room. Casinos want their high rollers in deluxe suites, designed to make them feel very powerful and important. Why do the casinos lavish such gaudy gifts on someone who has just taken piles of their money? To ensure that he doesn't leave. The more gifts they give, the longer the gambler will stay. The longer he stays, the more likely he is to cough up his winnings. In fact, because of the false sense of his own skill he acquired while racking up his temporary purse, he'll probably end up losing far more than he would have tolerated had he not found himself up in the first place. However cautious and determined people are when they begin, their good judgment goes out the window once they start to win. It's almost like they are determined to give back their winnings, and that is precisely what they do. This behavioral defect can be seen at work in our daily lives. People become less careful when they have more resources, which only ensures that they will soon part ways with those resources. We all know people who are perpetually penniless, often for valid reasons, like being a student, having a low-paying job, or having financially burdensome family and living expenses. But when these paupers come into a small sum of money, what do? Too often they blow it rapidly. Why do they do this? They finally have some financial resources that could be used to pay off nagging debts, upgrade a car or apartment, or make some durable purchase or a sensible investment. But no, they blow it on fancy clothes, expensive dinners, or nights of debauchery. This is not rational behavior. The joy they get from these dramatic expenditures is fleeting, while the debts they accrue are lasting. Most of us are very good at stretching a dollar when we have to, but not so good at making frugal choices without pressure. A small windfall could be used to make wise purchases that would provide long-term payoffs and even help save money in other ways, but most people are not capable of making good choices in that scenario. An even more widespread psychological flaw that is especially apparent in casinos is something known as the gambler's fallacy. This is the belief that a random event is more likely to happen if it hasn't happened in a while, or that a random event that has just taken place is unlikely to take place again anytime soon. Assuming that the events are unlinked, this is a complete delusion. In gambling, as in many situations in life, the past has no bearing on the present. When I'm at a casino, and I do go occasionally since, like everyone else, I'm not a perfectly rational being, one of my favorite activities is watching players at the roulette wheel. If the ball comes down on, say, 00 on the roulette table on one spin, there is nothing making it less likely to come down on 00 on the very next spin. The odds are exactly the same on each spin. Conversely, if a number has not been landed upon for several spins, the odds of it coming up in future turns are no greater than they were in the past. This is basic logic. Yet, inevitably, you will see players who have successfully bet on 00 shy away from that number in the next few spins. Or if this same number hasn't won in a very long time, you might see a bettor putting lots of money on it spin after spin. When it eventually wins, he will immediately start looking for another number to play. Again, one that hasn't won in a while. Casinos are happy to list all the previous winning numbers on the roulette table. They know that it doesn't actually matter, but that hapless gamblers like this hypothetical sucker think it does. Why do people fall for these tricks? Do they believe that the ball or the wheel somehow knows what happened in the previous spin, and that this somehow forces a different outcome on the next spin? Of course people don't consciously think this, but they do somehow think that the universe makes more sense than pure randomness would generate. Indeed, the gambler's fallacy is deep-seated in the human psyche, and sometimes disguises itself as intuition. If someone gives birth to three baby girls in a row, many people are convinced that the next one will be a boy. If this happens, their instincts are validated. If it doesn't, they shriek, "Wow, another girl! What are the odds?" About 50%, actually. The 350 million sperm that raced toward the egg that grew into that baby were blissfully unaware that three females had previously passed through there. Each birth is like a coin flip. A coin has no knowledge of its previous flips. It's possible to flip 10 heads in a row. When you go to flip the 11th time, the odds are 50-50 that it will be heads again. What explains the gambler's fallacy? Evolution. Our brains are like computers that evolved mostly to run programs called heuristics. Heuristics are rules that the brain establishes in order to make sense of the world quickly in ways that will help it, hopefully, make good decisions. When you observe something, you often unconsciously translate it into a larger pattern and assume that what you have observed is representative of a larger truth. It's true that this skill was, and is, extremely useful. If an ancestor of ours observed a lion hiding in shrubby underbrush, she might reason that shrubby underbrush was a spot where lions could be found, and she would be careful to avoid areas like that in the future. She extrapolated a larger truth from a single data point, and possibly saved her own life in the process. As useful as heuristics are, mental shortcuts can actually trip us up when we encounter a data set that is boundless. This is because the human brain is not built to comprehend infinity. We are trapped by the limits of finite math. For instance, when it comes to coin flips, we know that things should work out to 50-50 odds. So if someone observes four heads in a row, his brain applies this observation to a finite data set. The unconscious reasoning is something like, there were just four heads in a row, so there needs to be some tails coming soon in order to achieve the required 50-50 ratio. This small number thinking probably served our ancestors well in the development of pattern recognition and learning, but in modern times, it misfires in various ways, particularly when we're faced with probability and the math of big numbers. Back to our gamblers. As if failing to quit while they're ahead weren't bad enough, people also have difficulties in quitting when they're already deep in the hole. How many times have you heard someone say, or said yourself, "Oh, just one more hand and I'll get it back," or the even more explicitly wrong, "The house owes me after those last few hands," as if some ledger is being kept and the cards, or dice or roulette balls, must act to balance out past injuries. Nothing could be farther from the truth. When you're in the middle of a losing streak, it's worth remembering that the odds are slightly better that the streak will continue than that it will improve, because, as always, the odds always favor the house. The failure to quit when one is down is due to a related, possibly connected, fallacy termed sunk costs. Part of the reason that people have trouble walking away after losing money at the blackjack table is the notion that the money lost would be wasted if they didn't stay to try to win it back. Of course, this is a fallacy on top of a fallacy, because nothing done in one hand can improve the odds for the next, But that doesn't stop people from thinking this way. The sunk costs fallacy often gets wrapped up and packaged with wise, legitimate investment practices, such as the notion that you have to spend money to make money, and other such truisms regarding future rewards. Remember, not all money spent is an investment. Some money is simply lost, and trying to get it back should never be used as a reason to stay in a losing situation. If the dealer draws blackjack, neither the house nor the universe owes you a damn thing. This does not mean you are more likely to win the next one. You are in exactly the same place you were, just a little bit poorer. If the dealer draws 21 10 times in a row, he is just as likely to draw it again in the future. None of your lost bets buy you future odds. That money is simply gone. The fallacy of sunk costs can be seen in every sphere of human activity, not just in the casino. For instance, many amateur investors, which is almost everyone with a 401k, will consider how much they spent on a stock before deciding whether or not to sell. This makes no sense whatsoever. The only factor you should consider in deciding whether to sell or hold a stock is your belief about its future performance. It doesn't matter if you purchased it a day, month, year, or decade ago. If you think the stock will go up over the time you can hold it, you should hold it. If you think it will go down, you should sell it. It's that simple. Now, there might be good reasons to hold a losing stock. The price may be artificially low because of unfounded investor panic about the company or because of a temporary market depression that is likely to subside. Those are valid reasons. How much you paid for the stock when you first bought it is irrelevant. And yet, this is what people often consider most. In fact, most portfolio managing programs make this easy. They include a column, usually right next to the current value, indicating what was paid for the stock. This is a shame, because it reinforces the notion that it matters how much you've lost or gained in the past in deciding what to do going forward. If a stock has been steadily declining, that's a sign that it may be time to sell. However, a lot of times people put off the inevitable decision to sell to see if they can catch it on an upswing and at least get back what they paid for it. While they wait for that, the price continues to fall and they lose more money. It's not just the stock market. The fallacy of sunk costs can influence lots of financial decisions, usually for the worse. For example, when it's time to sell property, people are very reluctant to do so at a loss. They will hold on to houses and other property for extended periods, waiting for the market to recover, so that they can recoup what they paid for it. That may sound like a sound financial move, but it costs money to hold on to properties. There are annual tax bills, utilities, and maintenance costs. People rarely consider those costs when they hold on to a house longer than they should. In addition, if the property is not being used for housing or to generate income, that capital is simply tied up doing nothing, when it could be doing something. The sunk costs fallacy dooms decisions people make as individuals, as well as ones they make as a society. Soon after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, it became clear that the continued military occupation of the country was no longer fruitful for anyone involved. The U.S. military had won the war by deposing and disarming the previous regime. But in the wake of this destabilization, widespread violence, terrorism, and chaos reigned. The United States continued its occupation with the goal of rooting out the insurgent fighters and bringing stability to the country. Eventually, the continued presence of American troops was itself a destabilizing force, the linchpin of radicalization and terrorist recruitment. Even after everyone began to acknowledge this grim reality, there was strong resistance to pulling military forces out of Iraq. The political arguments routinely invoked the lives lost and the money spent arguments. We've already given so much. It can't all be for nothing. America may certainly have a moral responsibility to try to help the Iraqi people, but that's a different issue, one whose solution cannot be a military one. The sunk costs fallacy pops up any time people feel that they've invested time, effort, or money in something and don't want to see that sacrifice go to waste. Of course, that is understandable, but it can fly in the face of logic. On occasion, it simply doesn't matter how much you've invested. Sticking with a failing plan will only cost you more. In these instances, it can be very hard to see through your own stubbornness, but cutting your losses might be the smart thing to do. The price is wrong. The gambler's fallacy and the sunk costs fallacy are two specific ways that we screw up our lives when it comes to money or other resources. But it turns out that we make even more fundamental errors when it comes to things of value. We routinely goof up the process of assigning value in the first place. Consider the games that retailers can play with price tags and how effective their ploys are. For example, many studies have shown that consumers gravitate toward items that are marked as discounted, regardless of the actual final price. A $20 shirt will move much faster if it is priced at $40 and then discounted to 50% off. We humans measure value in relative terms, not absolute ones. We also have an anchoring bias. People give a great deal of value to the first piece of information they receive, regardless of its trustworthiness. This leads all further information to be valued not in strict terms, but relative to the original. Using the example mentioned, the first piece of information is the original, inflated price of the shirt. This makes the sale price of $20 seem much lower by comparison. The same is true in a salary negotiation or a home purchase. The first person to name a figure always sets the bar, and all of the parties in the negotiation perceive and value every counteroffer that follows relative to that opening bid. Savvy salary negotiators always make their first request way above what they think they will get. They know that this allows managers to feel like they got a deal by getting the employee to accept 5% to 10% less, even if this is still more than they initially intended to pay. This cognitive bias is so ingrained in the human social psyche that people rarely even question it. I experienced this firsthand when I was contacting solar power companies to come look at my home and make proposals. I found myself comparing every offer with the first one. The first offer happened to be way inflated because the company did not have a history of building the kind of system that I wanted, and basically didn't want the job. After getting several lower bids, I was left feeling that installing solar panels was cheap. Only when I discussed the bids with my dear spouse was I reminded that these offers were all way above what I originally said I would spend. Why did the people at that first company give me a sky-high bid instead of just passing on the job? Perhaps they felt that if they charged me way too much, it would make up for however much it cost them to take on a job that wasn't really in their wheelhouse. More likely, however, they knew that by giving a very high bid, they would leave me with the impression that they were the Cadillac of solar companies. It worked, too. Several weeks later, I caught myself telling a friend, "Now, if you can afford it, probably the highest quality company out there is..." What was I talking about? I had no idea about the quality of the craftsmanship of that or any other company. All I knew was the bid. But that was enough. The contractors had successfully convinced me that they ran a superior company by inflating their price, and I was perfectly happy to serve as their unpaid spokesman. Valuation biases are well known to marketing and sales professionals. The beverage industry is just one of the many sectors of the economy where these professionals can draw on scientific research to sell more products. For instance, studies have shown that people will avoid wine that is priced too low because they think it reflects poor taste or quality. Blind taste tests have demonstrated that people's perceptions are actually altered when fake price tags are put on bottles. Faked higher prices make people like the wine better, while lower price tags, but not actually cheaper wine, make people turn up their noses. When the deceit is revealed, the participants in these studies, while often embarrassed, frequently confessed that the higher-priced wine really did seem to taste better. It was not merely a matter of trying to impress the researcher. False valuation actually affects perceptions, including taste. As wine salespeople know, valuation biases can work in the opposite direction as well. Next time you go to a nice wine store, take note of the prices. A single bottle of expensive wine is often thrown in with middle-priced bottles to make those bottles look cheap by comparison. That single bottle might not actually cost that much. It could be a very cheap bottle with a big inflated price tag. It's just there for show anyway. Similarly, a bottle of cheaply priced wine can be thrown in to make the others look more respectable. This too can be done with false pricing. When a wine merchant is down to her last bottle of something, she'll often mark it way down and then use it to help move some other kind of wine that isn't selling well. Let's say there are $10 bottles of Merlot that haven't been moving. If she sets a bottle with a $6 price tag right next to them, suddenly they start to look better. Of course, once she's ready to unload the $6 bottle, all she has to do is put a $15 price tag above the other one, and then put a big X through it. It'll sell in minutes. By now, you have probably realized that many of the cognitive biases and errors common in humans manifest most acutely in the handling of money, whether it's gambling, markets, or financial planning. Of course, currency is a human invention with no direct correlate in the natural world. And for most of human history, economics involved the exchange of actual commodities, things that were useful in and of themselves, not arbitrary representations of value. Thus, it shouldn't be surprising that we haven't evolved the cognitive skills to manage currency. It's purely a conceptual construct with no biological basis, and that's why so many people choose to rent their homes and buy their cars instead of the other way around. But while money itself is relatively new, the ways in which we misuse it reflect ancient glitches in our species' mental circuitry. That claim is less surprising when you consider that, although human cognitive capacity evolved in a world where currency did not exist, resources certainly did exist. And thus, so did the concept of value and its impact on decisions. Humans have always had a relationship with goods, services, and real estate, the tangible things that bring value to the possessor. Goods can be things like food, tools, or even trinkets. Services can be things like cooperation, alliances, grooming, midwifery. Yes, it has existed for a long time. And so on. Real estate means that certain locations are more coveted than others for building a camp, nest, hunting blind, and so on. Economic forces, in other words, predate currency by quite a long time. Although it's hard to compare our species' current relationship with valuable resources to its past one, insofar as we can measure it, other animals make many of the same errors that we do. For example, many animals purchase sexual access with food or other gifts. There are penguins that trade sex for nest-building materials. If you're interested, I have a whole section on prostitution among animals in my book, Not So Different. In bird colonies, nest location often correlates with social rank, and there is the equivalent of a bustling real estate market complete with attempted evictions and robberies. Nature offers many examples of how animals try to dominate resources above and beyond what they need to thrive and reproduce. Greed and envy are not uniquely human traits. Our species may have invented currency, but we are not the first to engage in economic transactions, and thus neither are we the first to confront issues of economic psychology. Just how similar our flawed economic thinking is to that of other animals is becoming clear, thanks to research involving our primate cousins. Dr. Lori Santos, an animal behaviorist and evolutionary psychologist, has spent years establishing monkeynomics, an environment in which Capuchin monkeys have been trained to use and understand currency. From the many papers she has published on this fascinating work, The most important lesson is that monkeys exhibit many of the same irrational behaviors as humans do when it comes to resources. They are loss-averse, meaning they will take foolish risks when faced with the prospect of losing money that they've already earned. Risks they wouldn't take in order to earn the same amount. They also, like us, measure value in purely relative terms and can be tricked into changing their choices by price manipulation, like we are at the wine store. The fact that monkeys have a lot of the same cognitive flaws that we do points to a deeper evolutionary truth about our defective economic psychology. Behaviors that we now see as erroneous and irrational, falling for one's own confirmation bias, for instance, or making decisions based on the sunk costs fallacy, likely served our pre-agriculture ancestors well, as such things as roulette tables and beachside condominiums had not yet been invented. Likewise, when resources were used purely for subsistence, rather than social status, comfort, or power, the system of measuring value in purely relative terms probably made good sense. Furthermore, the stakes, and thus the evolutionary pressures, are high for animals in the wild, and our ancestors were no different. For most modern humans in the developed world now, losing some money generally means that they might have to scale back some aspects of their lifestyles. Losing resources in the Pleistocene epoch might have meant starvation. Thus, extreme aversion to loss also made good sense. When the alternative is an almost certain death, taking a risk doesn't seem so foolish. Desperate times call for desperate measures. So the flaws in our economic thinking did serve an evolutionary purpose. But as wine merchants, the casino industry, and many other economic opportunists know well, this feature is a significant bug. Power of the anecdote. Another form of human irrationality is found in our species' extreme sensitivity to the influence of anecdotes. Often, one particular event in your life, or even something told to you by someone else, can overpower everything else you know about the phenomenon in question. This effect is a subset of a larger fallacy known as neglect of probability. I was once a passenger in a friend's car as he prepared to merge onto an interstate highway from the city streets. As he approached the point of merger, he slowed the car down and eventually came to a full stop so that he could look over his shoulder and observe the oncoming traffic on the highway behind us. I shouted in disbelief, "What are you doing?" He responded, "One time I was merging into highway traffic and got into an accident, and now I just wait until there is a total break in traffic before I get on the highway." My friend had succumbed to the power of an anecdote. Both driver's education courses and the rules of the road agree that it is safer and more efficient to keep moving as one merges into traffic from a ramp. There is ample road to accomplish this on interstate highways. It's actually dangerous to stop because cars could be approaching at high speed from the ramp behind you and, depending on road and lighting conditions, may not be able to come to a full stop in time to avoid a collision. My friend had no doubt been in cars many times when drivers, including himself, safely merged into highway traffic. Yet one bad incident totally changed his thinking and his behavior, leading him to drive less safely in an attempt to drive more safely. Of course, large data sets are simply collections of individual anecdotes, but their size is what makes them so powerful. By assembling and analyzing lots of different data points, researchers can find statistical patterns and hidden truths that individuals relying exclusively on their own limited reservoirs of experience cannot possibly see. Yet, anecdotes convince us when statistics cannot, because data doesn't move us. Stories do. Stories carry more weight with us than generalized statistics do, because we can relate to the protagonists of a story and feel empathy for them. We cannot feel empathy for data. Playing the lottery is a different form of worshiping anecdotes over statistics. My parents have been playing the lottery for as long as I can recall. They don't waste their money on scratch-offs and small payouts in the pick three and pick four games. No, they go for the big lotteries, which promise life-transforming amounts of money. Over the years, my parents have surely thrown away tens of thousands of dollars that could have been put to very good use, as my parents are penny pinchers who use their money wisely in every other way. Anytime I remind them of this, my mother defends herself with the purchasing hopes and dreams logic that is as flimsy as it is common. After all, hopes and dreams are free. My parents, like everyone else who plays the lottery, are moved by stories of nurses winning $1 million. They see people on television receiving the check and think, "That could be me." What they don't see is the several million people who are each a few dollars poorer for having purchased the lottery ticket. The power of the anecdote reigns supreme. People often combine the power of anecdotes and the confirmation bias to support their positions on any number of social issues. If you think government welfare is wasteful, you probably have a ready example to prove your point. If you think that corporations ignore environmental destruction, you likely can list catastrophes wrought by evil industries. You surely can recount exactly why so-and-so is the best quarterback in the NFL, although none of these have as much evidentiary power as a large set of data and accompanying statistical analysis, they're much more convincing in an argument. And that's just bananas. The reason that anecdotes are so much more powerful than data is once again that our minds are trapped in the world of finite math and small numbers. Our brains evolved on a planet where humans came into contact with no more than a couple hundred people in their lives. It was crucial for them to draw conclusions from what they saw and what they learned from others, so they wouldn't have to learn every lesson themselves. Questions about how government policies affect millions of people were just never on the docket while our species was taking shape. Today, we can use pen and paper, or, computers, to crunch the numbers. But our brains will never really be able to wrap themselves around large numbers, even when we're able to complete math problems mentally. You might be able to compute 10 million times 300 billion in your head, but you can't really comprehend 10 million of anything. Because early human societies were never larger than a couple hundred individuals, there was no need to understand mathematical conceptualizations larger than that. Therefore, that skill simply didn't evolve. Some have even argued that the human brain is naturally wired to understand only three numbers: one, two, and many. An argument bolstered by the discovery that the Piraha tribe of South America has words for only those three numbers. While there is vigorous debate on what numbers, if any, humans have hardwired conceptions of, there is little debate that the human brain is poorly designed for mathematics. We often pay a price for that, literally, in the case of lottery addicts. But when it comes to another one of our cognitive defects, the cost is even higher. Youth is wasted on the young. The clichés are well known. Old people drive slowly and carefully and always wear their seatbelts. Young people are reckless and inattentive behind the wheel. These statements seem so obvious that we often forget how paradoxical they are. Shouldn't young people, with their whole lives ahead of them, be more careful when operating the deadliest machine most of them will ever come in contact with? And shouldn't old people, with such precious little time left, want to get places quickly? This conundrum is more than just a cliché, however. It's backed by data. Young people are indeed the most dangerous drivers, the least likely to buckle their seatbelts, and largely indifferent to safety features when selecting cars to purchase. Youthful reckless driving is not a function of inexperience either, because studies have shown that novice drivers who are more mature when they begin to drive are almost as successful at avoiding accidents as more experienced drivers. It's age, not skill, that appears to lead to caution and care behind the wheel, something that car rental companies have long recognized. They often refuse to rent to drivers under the age of 25. If it were simply a matter of experience, the policy would instead be against drivers with fewer than 8 or 9 years of driving experience. But it's not. It is youth itself that makes some drivers just not worth the risk. Of course, this phenomenon goes well beyond driving. Young people are bigger risk-takers in pretty much every way. They try dangerous and illegal drugs at much higher rates. They're much less likely to use protection when having sex. Young people are much more likely to enjoy extreme sports, such as bungee jumping, skydiving, rock climbing, base jumping, and so on. Even when there are safety measures in place, these activities are pretty risky, and in any case, they give the people who participate in them the perception of danger, which is at least partly responsible for the thrill. Psychologists often treat habitual thrill seekers as addicts. They're addicted to the adrenaline rush that accompanies danger. Young people seem to actually enjoy being in danger. One manifestation of this phenomenon is cigarette smoking. Young people will take up this habit even though they all know cigarettes are deadly. In fact, smoking is very unpleasant the first time you do it. I remember my first few cigarettes. I felt a harsh, stinging pain in my throat, and I immediately coughed. The nicotine made me feel lightheaded and eventually nauseated. Some people even vomit while enjoying their first cigarettes. Despite the unpleasantness, I didn't stop. I actually worked to get myself addicted to smoking. Each cigarette was a little bit easier to take, and the nausea eventually gave way to a mild relaxation. By then, I was hooked, and it took me 20 years to kick the habit. 6 years after finally quitting, I still curse myself for having started in the first place. If someone makes it to the age of 25 without picking up a cigarette, he has an almost zero chance of starting after that. The label of non-smoker is pretty firmly established even by the time a person hits 21. As people mature, they become far too wise to start a habit as foolish as smoking, especially since the first try is so awful. Who the hell would be irrational enough to keep at it? Well, I was, and so are millions of other kids. So the question is not who, but why. The key to understanding risky behaviors lies in another basic fact. They are more prevalent not only in young people, but also in males. Young adult males are the most dangerous demographic of the population. And the reason for that is even stupider than the risky behaviors themselves. They do stupid things in order to impress people. Young people, particularly but not exclusively males, take insane risks in order to advertise their fitness. This does not necessarily mean displaying physical prowess, although it can certainly be that. The term fitness display comes from the study of animal behavior and refers to ways that animals communicate to potential mates, as well as potential rivals, that they are forces to be reckoned with. It's a way of saying, "I am so powerful that I can do this dangerous thing and still come out okay." If we use the analogy of smoking, the coded message is, "I am so healthy that I can survive doing what we all know is incredibly unhealthy." If young men were taking these risks purely for their own thrill, they would take them when they were alone. But they don't. Until, in the case of cigarettes, they become addicted to the nicotine. The crazy behavior is always done in full view. The larger the audience, the better. Displays of fitness have a long evolutionary history, and there are many different types. But for our purposes, the ones that matter fall into a specific category that biologists call costly signals. Costly signals are responsible for some of the more conspicuous examples of sexual selection found in nature. For instance, the enormous tail of the peacock and the bulky antlers of the stag serve no other purpose than attracting mates. And they are costly. It burns many calories to carry them, and they reduce the animal's speed and mobility. While it is true that some horned mammals use their horns to fight among themselves, many never or rarely do so. The antlers and the tails are mostly for display, to show the females how strong they are. How does a huge tail show off strength? Well, you try lugging that enormous thing around everywhere you go without starving to death or getting killed. The handicap principle states that sexual selection sometimes leads to the evolution of ridiculous impediments to survival that exist purely so the male can display feats of strength. These examples of runaway selection are hardly good for the overall health and vitality of the species. Yet, those enormous antlers that are purely for show, they work. Female deer are strongly attracted to large and elaborate antlers. Size matters. Same for the tail of the peacock. Peahens dig it. Applying the handicap principle to behavior is tricky, and applying it to humans is trickier still. However, there is solid evidence for doing so. Studies have confirmed that young females experience stronger sexual attraction to males who display risky behaviors, particularly those involving feats of physical strength. Young women will score the same male as more attractive when they see him playing football than when they see him playing the piano. Even more telling is the fact that males are impressed by their fellow males when they see them taking risks. Doing things like drag racing, cliff diving, and smoking cigarettes helps a young man earn and keep male friends. In evolutionary terms, these are male-male alliances, and they can prove very valuable in securing a prized place in the dominance hierarchy of social species up to and including humans. And if you're a male, the higher you are in your dominance hierarchy, the greater your chances of reproductive success. We humans like to think we're above all that, but I suspect everything in this section sounds familiar to anyone who survived high school. By contrast, young males tend to be more sexually attracted to females who take fewer risks. This may help explain why males are drawn to taking risks more than females are. There is a potential payoff for them, but not for females. This also supports the notion that, in mammals, individual males are fairly expendable, while females are a limiting factor for the survival and success of the species. In this view, each female is precious, and males are generally drawn to females who show signs of caution and care, and thus will be able to ensure the survival of their children. Females, however, worry less about caution in their mates and instead want good genes for their offspring. This is a dramatically overgeneralized view, of course, but like the clichés about age and risk aversion, it has some grounding in truth. It's basically a truism that the jocks get the girls in high school, while the geeks get passed over, even though the latter are probably more likely to experience real-world success later in life. By that time, the tables get turned, but it's too late for many women and men because they're done reproducing. And while it might be tempting to think that the recent increase in the age of first reproduction among humans will reduce costly displays of fitness among young men and make smart, sensitive young men more attractive to their peers, this is unlikely to have any quick impact. An evolutionary transformation like that would require a genetic difference between risk-takers and safe players, followed by many generations of selective pressure. Absent those factors, humans can count on adolescent boys doing stupid things for some time to come. An important implication of this bug in our brains is that much of the public awareness programming aimed at reducing rates of smoking, drinking, drug use, and other risky behaviors may be totally backward in its approach. While explaining the risks of drugs to a high school student might seem like a logical way to dissuade him from trying them, it probably has the opposite effect. Explaining that drugs are risky could make them more attractive to kids, especially young boys. There is wisdom indeed behind another old saw. There is no better way to raise interest in something than by banning it. In the primate brains of young boys, if drugs are dangerous and illegal, the people who try them must be really strong and brave. Could there be a clearer cognitive flaw than that? Coda, Saints and Sinners. How humans became so much more intelligent than our closest relatives in such a short time is one of the biggest mysteries of evolution. While it's obvious that high intelligence has survival advantages and would thus be favored by natural selection, it is actually a fairly improbable feature for a species to evolve. First of all, evolving to be smarter requires a fairly ordered progression of a lot of mutations, such as those allowing the expansion of the cranium, the growth of the brain itself, greater interconnectedness of brain areas, and so on. Second,